trial notice. 2020 PM. Heilmeier explains, 9 o'clock will be hour X.
Hour X. This was kind of a parole used by the communications center of the Munich police to mark a special time. It should say, one more hour and we are about to take action against the terrorists. Very early in the morning, the Palestinians assaulted the Israeli team in the Olympic Village. 2 out of the 11 hostages were killed shortly after. One of them, the wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg, was carried outside the building. It takes more than an hour that he's lying there until his dead body is taken away. The other remains in the apartment, lying dead on the floor for the whole time, murdered, tortured. Then, all over the day, negotiations, ultimatums that expire and get extended one after the other, threatenings. We reconstructed this procedure along a minute-by-minute protocol from the early morning until the evening, up to the point when the terrorists left the Olympic Village with their hostages and flew in helicopters to Fürstenfeldbruck, where it all would be ending in a chaotic shootout. What happened after taking off of Fürstenfeldbruck till the end? That is what this episode is about.
Geheimakte 1972. Das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972. Die ganze Geschichte.
Hochwey September mehr allein, 11, kulam
Episode 8. Das Fiasko von Fürstenfeldbruck.
Statement of the incidents on September 5th and September 6th, 1972, on the Fürstenfeldbruck airfield. Heinz M., Munich City Police Officer.
On Tuesday, September 5th, 1972, I enlisted myself as a volunteer for a special raid at the airfield Fürstenfeldbruck. Around 7 o'clock in the evening, me and some other guys were flown in a helicopter from Munich to Fürstenfeldbruck. We were instructed to free the hostages out of a Lufthansa airplane that should be standing there waiting for them to board. For this purpose, we were dressed in fitter's overalls of yellow, green, and blue color. We had to repeat our request for weapons several times before being equipped with P-38 pistols from the city police and the German army.
The person who wrote this down is a policeman. He will play an important role in this episode. He is delivering insights telling us why the police raid in Fürstenfeldbruck failed that tragically. But we are not that far yet. From 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., no one really knew if when and where the police would take action. Hectic negotiations. Decisions made and withdrawn the next minute.
Criminal Police Director M. talks to the Federal Ministry for Air Traffic about acquiring a Lufthansa jet plane to be parked on the Fürstenfeldbruck airfield. But the plane could be sent only from 9 o'clock, not earlier.
And this is the plan as the Minister for the Interior, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, agreed upon with a terrorist's leader named Issa. You let the hostages survive. We are giving you the aircraft and let you fly to the Middle East. Did Genscher really mean that? We will learn from now on, but at the moment, police and public authorities fight their self-created chaos.
8:30 p.m. Vice Minister Kiesel announces he will be taking leadership if the crisis staff doesn't return from Fürstenfeldbruck on time.
Exactly at this time, Georg Wolf, chief of the operation in Fürstenfeldbruck and vice police president of Munich, is sitting in a helicopter back to the Olympic Village.
8:40 p.m. Police vice president enters the operations office and announces, firstly, thing to be done prioritized there on site.
The thing means storming the house and freeing the hostages.
Secondly, if they send conditions, we will be storming. Shooters to the take position. Thirdly, if thing won't work, here shock squad to Fürstenfeldbruck by helicopter.
Situation is at this time no sharpshooter left in Fürstenfeldbruck since they were flown by helicopter from there back to Munich to the Olympic Village. Now Wolf notices just that.
8:45 p.m. Wolf orders the helicopter crews not to land in Fürstenfeldbruck before the sharpshooters landed there and took position.
In other words, Wolf is afraid that the terrorists and their hostages may arrive in Fürstenfeldbruck before the police forces had the chance to configure themselves. There are periods when the central office in Munich doesn't know what's going on in the Olympic Village. Or if someone actually negotiates with the terrorists, and if so, who?
8:50 p.m. Public radio reports about further negotiations between the terrorists and the crisis staff.
Someone is listening to the radio news, with come up with an information they don't have internally, and so registers it. Meanwhile, in Fürstenfeldbruck, where things go chaotic as well.
8:51 p.m. Feds push a crowd of spectators off the side around an emergency vehicle.
In fact, hundreds make their way to Fürstenfeldbruck expecting a spectacle. They will not be disappointed. Some minutes later in the Olympic Village.
9:05 p.m. Sharpshooters ordered to bus at Building 8.
Now we come close to a critical moment. The police leadership follows every single step the terrorists take. They are waiting for the chance to action. For a moment when the terrorists leave their shelter in the apartment of the Israeli team, along with their hostages, when they are on their way to the bus or to the helicopter.
It is heard via wireless communication that a bus drove up next to Building 31. In this bus, perpetrators and hostages shall be brought to the helicopter.
One member of the crisis staff, Chief Detective Schmidt, watches on site.
Around 9 p.m., the leader of the terrorists inspected the way from the house to the helicopter's landing site. He then refused walking this way by foot with the hostages. Therefore, he demanded a bus, which was provided.
9:15 p.m. Mr. D. of the Arnold Richter Company is keeping ready an infrared night view camera for the president. President cannot be reached.
The bus is there, but the terrorists refuse it as too small. A bigger bus is being ordered and coming. This is what terrorists Sameh and Al-Navi testify about how it continues.
After we had arrived at the helicopters by bus, Issa got out alone and inspected the helicopters. He was armed with a machine gun. In total, we were 9 Israelis and 8 Palestinians.
The Israelis had all their hands tied. At the same time, they were tied together in two groups. I went down in the basement with the second group. About 5 meters from the basement door, there was a bus waiting and we went in. I was sitting behind the driver and didn't have any particular duty. I was sitting in a position that could overlook backwards the entire cabin. Issa was sitting next to the driver and Tony in the back. While the bus drove to the helicopters, the doors remained closed. The bus then stopped next to the helicopter and Issa went out with 4 of the Israelis and led them to the first helicopter. Our comrades with the numbers 2, 4, and 7 went into the same helicopter. Then Issa returned and said we should lead the other Israelis to the second helicopter. They were 5 Israelis with tied hands. We also tied them together. They were taking their places on the bench. I myself sat down to the right side behind the bench. Issa was sitting right behind the pilot. Issa still had not taken his seat when the other helicopter with Tony took off, shortly after we also were departing.
9:45 p.m. Sharpshooters to Fürstenfeldbruck.
It was the last moment, literally. 5 so-called sharpshooters are flying to Fürstenfeldbruck. These 5 were the only sharpshooters there when the shooting began. just five, because police believed that there were also five terrorists only. Fatal failure. There were eight terrorists.
In one of the helicopters, I was together with Issa, two other comrades, and five Israelis. Issa and one of my comrades were sitting next to the pilot, and I and another comrade were watching the Israelis. The other helicopter left first. About 3 minutes later, we followed. There were no difficulties during the flight. We flew for about 15 to 20 minutes.
15 to 20 minutes. This is quite a while for this short distance from Munich to Fürstenfeldbruck. And it is not by chance that it takes that long. Crisis staff member Schmidt writing.
Around 10 p.m., both of the helicopters took off with the preparators and the hostages from landing site G1. Right away after the third helicopter took off and flew the crisis staff to Fürstenfeldbruck.
The third helicopter, the one with the crisis staff, is first landing in Fürstenfeldbruck. It passes the two others. The pilots were instructed to delay the arrival in Fürstenfeldbruck to allow the crisis staff to be there first. It was planned as well that the head of the Mossad, the Israeli secret service, should be in the helicopter of the crisis staff, but he wasn't. They just forgot him, says Anki Spitzer, wife of Andrei Spitzer, the Olympic fencing coach who was sitting in one of the other two helicopters.
In the meanwhile, the Krisenstab came to the airport. They forgot to take the head of the Mossad, Itam, you know, with them. So he got there after them. And he asked, what is your plan? What is going to happen now? And they said, well, they have a plan. They want the two leaders of the Palestinians to come to the airplane, the Lufthansa plane, which was there in front of the Fürstenfeldbruck airport. And then we have 14 policemen inside, and they should take them, you know, and kill them. And then we hope that the other terrorists are coming out of the helicopters because they flew with the hostages. And then we can shoot them too, and that is the end of it, because we are not going to let them. We told them that they can go with the plane abroad, but we are not going to let them out of Germany.
10.02 p.m. Request from ISA 2 for central office. Who will provide signal for departure? Central office answering. Chief of operation cannot be reached.
Right away, the police sends an investigation team in the apartment of the Israeli team. One member of this team is a medic, member of the medical staff of the Olympic Village. He remembers.
I was running into the house with a policeman. On the upper floor, we found the body of a young man entirely covered with a white sheet. I uncovered the body from head to feet and determined his death. There were several wounds from bullets, for instance, in the thorax. His scrotum was fully shredded.
It were the remains of Israeli weightlifter Yosef Romano. He was 32 years old.
p.m. Bus leaving the Olympic Village. 10:12 p.m. Departure of two helicopters with perpetrators and hostages.
And now? 14 policemen shall be waiting in a Lufthansa plane for Issa and Tony trapping the terrorists, dressed in overalls, yellow, green and blue for whatever reason. These 14 officers shall stop the terrorists. This is the plan, but it doesn't work. When doing research for this podcast, I spent weeks in the Staatsarchiv München, the state archive in Munich. It was kind of my second home. Every morning I entered this massive building next to Munich Odeonsplatz, went upstairs, entered the reading hall and took my place. On the table, always ready, stacks of files. Usually, I occasionally grabbed just one and started scrolling through the pages. Most files were fairly chaotic. Completed forms, letters typed on typewriters, faded copies of decades-old telexes, and so forth. Browsing this stuff is fairly tiring. Most of it is irrelevant. I read lots of more or less meaningless detail. and then again turned a page, and on a sudden realized, this here is different, exciting, telling an important part of the story. In this case, I stumbled upon a long and detailed report written by one of these 14 policemen who were in the plane with these yellow, green and blue overalls. One of these who were instructed to overturn the terrorists in the plane, one of these volunteers the police chiefs were looking for. And now I was sitting in this archive reading room and had this report in hand. Seeing it was classified until 2041, but being allowed to take notes so that I start typing all of it into my laptop computer. The name of this police officer, Heinz M. Here he explained what happened in the airplane with him and his colleagues.
We all had massive doubts that this could work, and we all decided to cancel the job. We had two reasons. One was our lack of safety. The other was that we saw no chance of being successful. Our camouflage, pretending we were fitters, was useless. Nobody would have seriously believed that in such a situation, someone could be busy in cleaning ashtrays or cleaning windows. The interior of the plane was really bad for our operation too. The cabin was separated with several dividing walls, which blocked our field of view and therefore our chances to aim and shoot. At the same time, they were too thin to stop the bullets. The plan to fool the terrorists by placing two of us in the cockpit was cancelled because the entrance to the plane was directly behind the cockpit. So we would have fired in the direction of the cockpit and consequently would have undoubtedly hit our own colleagues. Because of the limited space, we would not have had the opportunity to shoot in any other direction. Then we realized that the tanks were not empty, as planned. In the case of an explosion, not only the aircraft would have been destroyed, but because of the fuel, the entire tower building would have been destroyed as well. The main reason for our refusal, however, was that we could not see any chance of success. We definitely could not expect all the terrorists and all the hostages to board the plane at the same time, and we were right, as it turned out in the end. Even if we had succeeded in overpowering the leader of the terrorists without any noise and gunfire, the other terrorists would have become suspicious. It might have even been impossible to save the life of the pilots of the helicopters.
The takeoff of the helicopters again is live on TV all over the world, including the Netherlands. Anki Spitzer watches. She knows that in one of these helicopters, her husband is sitting.
So my mother said, that's the first time I heard her, that because they didn't want to disturb me all the time. They said, maybe now it's going to be okay, because now they'll be able to negotiate or something. I said, Mother, if they're taking them out of the Olympic Village, it's only because they want to continue with their Heitere Spiele, and they want this thing out of the Olympic Village. They want it on some way out little airport, out of the lights. And she said, no, that cannot be. But then I suddenly see the helicopters going into the air. It was all live on television, you know. And I thought of André, and I thought to myself, what is going through his mind, you know? What happened to him the whole day to be tied up and to be tortured because they broke their bones also, and to see his teammate, which I didn't know at that time, you know, what really happened to him, but something happened, he was shot. And now he's in a helicopter, and where is he going?
The first helicopter is landing in Fürstenfeldbruck, the one with the crisis staff, with police Vice President Georg Wolf, Minister Genscher, Bavarian Prime Minister Franz Josef Strauß, and again Chief Detective Schmidt. He remembers.
Right away after landing, I went into the tower building and lay on the tower platform next to the sharpshooters. Around 10:40 p.m., the helicopters with the terrorists and the hostages arrived. They were landing on the illuminated apron in front of the tower and not too long distance between each other.
This is what Chief Detective Schmidt had in memory. However, the exact time when the helicopters land is 10:32. The 14 policemen just had left the plane.
As we left the plane, we saw the helicopters landing. We searched for shelter somewhere in the area, and behind a corner of the tower was the spot where I hid. Unfortunately, I couldn't see all what happened from that place. First, one terrorist left the helicopter and another the second helicopter, and both came closer. Both of them were armed with machine guns.
Same situation from the terrorist's perspective.
Then we landed on some airfield, I can't remember its name. The place where we landed was brightly lit. Not far from the two helicopters, there was a Lufthansa plane, which was also illuminated. The two helicopters were about 10 meters apart. They were parallel, side by side. Our helicopter was flown by a pilot and a co-pilot. Right after we landed, Issa got out first on the right-hand side. He walked around the front of the helicopter and then stopped between the two helicopters. I got off on the left side and with me another comrade. The Israelis had instructions from Issa to stay in the helicopter for the time being. The pilot also stayed in the machine.
And this is how Chief Detective Schmidt sees it.
At first, one terrorist out of each of the two helicopters stepped out, both armed with machine guns. They approached each other. After talking briefly, they went to the Lufthansa jet plane. At the same time, the helicopter crew stepped out, and also one more terrorist from each of the helicopters armed as well with machine guns. From the perspective of the tower, the terrorists could not be seen clearly because the helicopter crew stood in their way. The two other terrorists went in the plane and then returned to the helicopters.
The time now, 10:38 p.m., 6 minutes after the helicopters landed. Another police chief climbs on the tower platform, Georg Wolf, head of the operation himself. He is lying between two of the sharpshooters. There's a reason why he's lying there. The police doesn't have walkie-talkies in Fürstenfeldbruck for whatever reason. Wolf orders the two officers next to him to shoot as Issa and Tony return to the helicopters. They shoot. Some of the other three sharpshooters start shooting as well, at least those who have a target in sight. They were instructed to shoot whenever they hear their colleagues shooting, due to the fact that they don't have walkie-talkies.
When they had taken two-thirds of their way, the first shot was fired.
Similar perception from terrorists' perspective.
Tony and Issa had just passed the first helicopter and were halfway to ours when suddenly there was a shooting. It came from the front side of a house there. On the left side from our helicopter, I saw the white helmet of one of the pilots. Right before the first shots, I noticed that the pilot went some step backwards to the tail of the helicopter. He also spoke something in the microphone that was mounted into his helmet. When the first shots were fired, I placed myself on the ground immediately.
Chief Detective Schmidt, lying up there on the tower, suddenly is under fire.
After the first shot, one of the terrorists was breaking down. It was the one who stood next to the helicopter at the eastern side. Then, after another shot, the other terrorist fell down. The terrorists who returned from the Lufthansa plane moved briskly and started running shortly before arriving the helicopters. Both then disappeared behind the helicopter parked on the western side. I cannot say if they have been hit by bullets. Two of the helicopter crew members tried to escape to the tower. They were shooting from the helicopters. I saw that next from the helicopter at the western side, sparks flying from the concrete. At the same time, bullets hit the tower and I was looking for shelter. I was hiding behind the parapet. I saw muzzle flash from the helicopter at the eastern side. I am quite certain that I noticed muzzle flash from within the helicopter at the western side. At that time, bullets hit the immediate vicinity. I was not able anymore to watch if or where terrorists or hostages came out.
Same scene, different perspective. Terrorist Altnavi.
Issa jumped into the helicopter and remained in it for about 5 minutes. He took position so that he could watch in the direction of the Germans. He also shot in this direction. Then he said we all should come into the helicopter. I stepped in and got on the floor immediately. I saw a lot of blood in the helicopter. The hostages were laying on their backs. Another Arab went into the helicopter. When he left again, he was hit by a bullet. I did not see that any of the Arabs had been shooting the hostages. Then I smelled something strange. My hands and feet were paralyzed. I heard something like church bells. I must have lost consciousness. When consciousness came back, the other helicopter burned.
Meanwhile, also the police officer Heinz M. climbs onto the tower platform.
After a while, I saw a man jumping out of the left door of the helicopter and standing on the right side. While jumping out, he threw a burning item into the helicopter. A fire burst out inside the helicopter. Dense brown and gray smoke appeared. Suddenly, the entire helicopter was on fire. I did not hear an explosion. I assume that this item was used to set off the fire. The terrorist who jumped out was immediately being shot at. When he reached the back of the helicopter, I could not see what happened next because the smoke was covering the scene. It seemed to me that the terrorist was going to fall to the ground, but then I saw a man running away towards the low concrete wall.
Terrorist Badran.
As I threw myself on the floor, there was a lot of shooting. I was able to differentiate if there were also shootings in or from inside the helicopters. I heard several shots from machine guns and other arms. When Zamir started screaming, which was at the beginning of the shooting, I also heard the Israelis crying. If they were crying because of fear or because they were hit by bullets, I don't really know. Some shots were subdued. I assume they were shot with silencers.
Is it possible that the Israelis cried because they were threatened by Abd al-Qadr or Abu al-Ala? Because one of them started shooting at the Israelis or ignited a hand grenade?
I don't know. I cannot answer this.
At midnight, at 12 o'clock...
Suddenly the probably most macabre scene at the bloody night.
Konrad Ahlers, who was the spokesperson of the German government, came on television and he says, "We had a difficult day, but I have very good news. All the Israelis were saved and all the terrorists were killed." Huh? And I said, "So I saw the explosions, I heard the fire, I heard the bullets and everything. How can he say this?" But my father said, "Anki, it's the official spokesman of the German government. And if he is saying it, I'm going to open a bottle of champagne." And everybody started to cheer, my brothers and my sisters. And they said, "What a terrible day, but wonderful, he is saved." I said, no. I said, "I'm going to wait and don't open the champagne bottle till Andre will call me. Because if he is saved, the first thing he will do is call me. Even if he is wounded or whatever, the first thing he will do is call me and I will wait for his phone call." So I waited, 12:30, I called the Olympic Village. They said, "We don't know," to the leader of the Israeli delegation. I said, "What is happening?" He said, "We are also waiting, we don't know, because we also heard the news that everything is okay. Call in a half an hour." So I called every half hour, and every time the news was worse, they said, "Maybe they are all wounded, maybe we don't know what happened." Till finally at 3:15 in the morning, Jim McKay, who was the ABC anchor, he said, "You know, they're all gone. They're gone." So then all my family, you know, everybody started to cry and to whatever. And I said, "I'm still going to make one phone call." After he said that, he said...
What was the situation in your home, in your parents' home in the Netherlands? Have you all the family sitting, in the living room, in front of the TV, or how can I imagine that?
Yes, nobody bothered me because I asked them not to. I said, "Just leave me alone." And they would come in and out, go to the hospital to give food to the baby, to give her a bottle and things like this. But they were all in the background. They have a very big home. So they were all waiting and also watching another TV and trying to see what was happening. But when they heard the good news, so they were cheering and they came and kissing me, and I got a lot of phone calls. I said, "I don't want to hear anyone till he calls." And then when they said that they're all gone, they're all killed, all murdered, then the whole family started to cry and everything. And I said, "I'm going to make one more phone call to the head of the delegation and to to make sure. So I'm talking in Hebrew, very little Hebrew that I spoke at that time because I was new in Israel. And the head of the delegation wasn't there yet anymore, but I spoke to one of the well-known sport journalists who I knew too, and he says, Anki, what they said on television, that's the truth. They're all gone. So I said, you know what? I heard that there is going to be a Gedenkfeier tomorrow morning at the Olympic Stadium in Munich. I'm going to be there. I'm going to try to get on a plane. But I ask you to be in touch with me and pick me up from the airport because I have no clue how I get to the Olympic Village. So all my family was listening. I'm speaking in Hebrew and I'm not starting to scream and to yell. And so I said to them, it's exactly what they said on television. They're all murdered. So then I called the Israeli ambassador in Holland, who went to sleep when after he heard the good news of Konrad Ahlers. And he said, well, Andre called. I said, well, he didn't call. And this is the situation. Send me a car, because nobody in my family is able to drive because they're all so sad and crying and everything. And get me on the first plane at 8 o'clock in the morning to Munich. And so they picked me up an hour later and they took me to the airport and I was on the plane. And I said to my, and if everybody wanted to come with me, I said, don't come with me. I'm going back to Munich. Just take care of the baby. And that's all I ask you. And I got into the car. I could not cry, and I did not cry for years, only because of the fact that I thought to myself, if I start crying, I can never stop. And I cannot allow myself to do that. So I went, I still remember I'm sitting in the plane. One of the stewardesses brings me the newspaper, the Telegraaf, the Dutch newspaper, and it had the pictures of all the victims on it. And she brings me the newspaper. She said, terrible, what happened in Munich, right? I said, yeah, it's really terrible. She had no idea who I was. So when she suddenly came back because somebody told her, and crying and crying, and I didn't know that. I said, well, how should you know? So I got there and they came to pick me up, two journalists. They took me to the Olympic Village, to the Gedenkfeier, to this memorial. And I must say it was really surrealistic because here I'm running, because I was pretty late, I'm running towards the stadium, and on both sides of the road, people are training. You know, there are fields there and people were training. And I think to myself, they just killed 11 people or 12 people, because also a German policeman was killed there. And people are as if nothing happened. They're just going there. So I went to this Gedenkfeier. And then I heard the fascist, racist, Avery Brundage, who was the president of the International Olympic Committee then. And he said, the games must go on.
The games must go on. Well, just that happened. Back to this night that changes Anki Spitzer's life and the lives of many other people forever. And back to Fürstenfeldbruck. It's midnight when the German government spokesman delivers his fake news. At that time, the police officer Heinz M. still continues his inspection walk over the apron. He still is the only police official there.
At the end of the concrete wall, I saw muzzle flashes again, but I don't know who was shooting. Shortly after the flames destroyed the entire helicopter, some fire trucks appeared. I now had the opportunity to get closer to the helicopters, went down and stood next to the fire trucks. I crawled as close as I could to the left of the two helicopters, the one that had not been destroyed by the fire. I heard no sound from the inside. I couldn't see into the interior because then I would have had to raise my head, which I didn't want to do to avoid possibly being shot by one of our snipers. They were unable to identify me as a police officer because I was still wearing my blue mechanics overall. Inside the helicopter, I only recognized two men who were obviously dead. I then tried to contact the snipers on the radio in one of the fire trucks, but was unsuccessful. Nobody responded. Then an armed police car approached. Someone fired at it. It withdrew immediately. As I was hiding behind a fire truck at that time, I could not see from where the shots came, but I saw sparks from the bullets bouncing off the ground. Later, two more armed vehicles came and they circled the helicopters. I heard a shot from one of the vehicles, and I guess that it came from an MG-42. Since I was only armed with a pistol and therefore felt outgunned, I took the Kalashnikov of one of the dead terrorists lying next to one of the helicopters. Unfortunately, I grabbed the gun of the terrorists who died from the explosion of his own hand grenade. The weapon was totally destroyed and I threw it away.
0:30 a.m. In Fürstenfeldbruck, a helicopter burns. One police officer died.
One of the policemen was hit by a bullet, Heinz Fliegerbauer. He stood at the door into the tower. Above, there were spotlights mounted. Possibly one of the terrorists tried to shoot out the spotlights and hit Fliegerbauer accidentally, but ran. At least this is what he testified, but the police doesn't believe him. His interrogation reads like this.
Mr. Badran, as we found out, it was you who killed the police officer. How do you comment on this?
No, I was shooting high, not low.
How will you know that the police officer was standing on the low level?
I noticed that the policemen must have been almost as high as the helicopters, because the helicopters were hit by bullets that flew horizontally.
This is false. The police sharpshooters were not positioned at same height than the helicopters. How do you comment on this?
I was shooting towards the light. I didn't see the police officers.
However, chances are that it was you to kill the officer.
If I had knew that there were police officers nearby the lights, I wouldn't have shot in this direction.
Can you exclude that when you started shooting, you not aimed low and later turned higher?
I am sure that I shot high for the spotlights.
What are you going to say when it turns out after forensic inspection that the bullets that killed the officer were shot out of your gun?
This is all I can say. I aimed for the lights. And I didn't want to shoot the policeman.
Officer Heinz M. continues his inspection walk. No more shooting in Fürstenfeldbruck.
I lay down under the front of the fire truck and watched from about 20 feet away an unarmed and obviously injured man slowly crawling under the rear of the right helicopter, the one that was on fire.
Heinz M. at the time must have been frightened to death, since he didn't know if any of the terrorists still was armed and ready to shoot. And the sharpshooters had bad visibility. It was dark, not enough spotlights. He must have been afraid of being targeted by one of his own people.
Later, a truck with headlights came and illuminated the whole scene. I was now more confident that the snipers would recognize me. I stood up and carefully moved closer to the helicopter, the one that was not burned out. Inside, I saw several people sitting, obviously dead. Halfway up their knees was another man, wearing a red shirt or sweater, who I assumed was also dead. Since the bright car disappeared a short time later, I could only see into the helicopter for only that brief moment. Then everything was in shadow again. Cautiously, I went on to the second, burned helicopter. Next to this helicopter were several bodies. Carefully, I checked that their hands were not hidden, but visible. Then I checked the bodies by lightly tapping them with my feet. I noticed a slight reaction in two of them. These two I tapped with my pistol barrel, convincing them to stand up. Both of them were no longer armed.
One of these two is Badran. This is how he describes it.
I woke up again when I was kicked by the foot of a police officer. I realized that I was all wet. Obviously, someone used foam to extinguish a fire. I smelled petroleum. Then I was searched and taken away.
They might have lost their Kalashnikovs during the firefight and then crawled under the rear of the helicopter to seek shelter. There were some hand grenades lying around, but not close to the survivors. Since we were told there were four, at most five terrorists, I was not sure who they were. I was not informed that there were 8. I asked one of them who he was, but he remained silent. With my pistol at the ready, I drove them to the tower. On the way, another police officer passed by. Some of my colleagues followed and assisted in taking the 2 terrorists to the tower. We took them to a room and undressed them. Then the detectives took over.
2 a.m. Broadcast news. IOC decided to continue the games. Closing ceremony on Sunday. Grief ceremony September 6th at 10 o'clock. 2:45 a.m. Israeli embassy asked to speak to Chief Detective Mela. Is being contacted via two-way radio. Doesn't get through from Fürstenfeldbruck. 3:25 a.m. Phone call about who will be informing the family of the killed police officer. Reitmoser tells this should be the duty of the administration staff. Name, Anton Fliederbauer. Wife, Maria. One son. 6:50 a.m. Wife of shot police officer notified. One officer remains in her apartment. Wife after recovery to be taken to room 452 in the morning or in the afternoon. 7:40 a.m. Investigation team leaves side.
It is not over. For long not over.
Geheimakte 1972. 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.
You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.